This is Audible.
Jonathan Livingston Seagull. A story written by Richard Bach. Narrated by Marcus Lovett. Music by Ken Miller. Published by Kindheart Productions. To the real Jonathan Livingston Seagull that lives within us all. Part 1. It was morning, and the new sun sparkled gold across the ripples of a gentle sea. A mile from shore, a fishing boat chummed the water, and the word for breakfast flock flashed through the air, till a crowd of 1,000 seagulls came to dodge and fight for bits of food. It was another busy day beginning. But way off alone, out by himself, beyond boat and shore, Jonathan Livingston Seagull was practicing. 100 feet in the sky, he lowered his webbed feet, lifted his beak, and strained to hold a painful, hard, twisting curve through his wings. The curve meant that he would fly slowly, and now he slowed until the wind was a whisper in his face, until the ocean stood still beneath him. He narrowed his eyes in fierce concentration, held his breath, forced one single more inch of curve. Then his feathers ruffled, he stalled and fell. Seagulls, as you know, never falter, never stall. To stall in the air is for them disgrace, and it is dishonor. But Jonathan Livingston Seagull, unashamed, stretching his wings again in that trembling hard curve, slowing, and stalling once more, was no ordinary bird. Most gulls don't bother to learn more than the simplest facts of flight, how to get from shore to food and back again. For most gulls, it is not flying that matters, but eating. For this gull, though, it was not eating that mattered, but flight. More than anything else, Jonathan Livingston Seagull loved to fly. This kind of thinking, he found, is not the way to make oneself popular with other birds. Even his parents were dismayed as Jonathan spent whole days alone making hundreds of low-level glides, experimenting. He didn't know why, for instance, but when he flew at altitudes less than half his wingspan above the water, he could stay in the air longer with less effort. His glides ended not with the usual feet-down splash into the sea, but with a long, flat wake as he touched the surface with his feet tightly streamlined against his body. When he began sliding into feet-up landings on the beach, then pacing the length of his slide in the sand, his parents were very much dismayed indeed. "Why, John, why?" his mother asked. "Why is it so hard to be like the rest of the flock, John? Why can't you leave low-flying to the pelicans, the albatross?"
"Why don't you eat, son? You're bone and feathers."
"I don't mind being bone and feathers, Mom. I just want to know what I can do in the air and what I can't, that's all. I just want to know." "See here, Jonathan," said his father, not unkindly. "Winter isn't far away. Boats will be few, and the surface fish will be swimming deep. If you must study, then study food and how to get it. This flying business is all very well, but you can't eat a glide, you know. Don't you forget that the reason you fly is to eat." Jonathan nodded obediently. For the next few days, he tried to behave like the other gulls. He really tried, screeching and fighting with the flock around the piers and fishing boats, diving on scraps of fish and bread. But he couldn't make it work. "It's all so pointless," he thought, deliberately dropping a hardwood anchovy to a hungry old gull chasing him. "I could be spending all this time learning to fly. There's so much to learn." It wasn't long before Jonathan Gull was off by himself again, far out at sea, hungry, happy, learning. The subject was speed, and in a week's practice, he learned more about speed than the fastest gull alive. From 1,000 feet, flapping his wings as hard as he could, he pushed over into a blazing steep dive toward the waves and learned why seagulls don't make blazing steep power dives. In just 6 seconds, he was moving 70 miles per hour, the speed at which one's wing goes unstable on the upstroke. Time after time it happened. Careful as he was, working at the very peak of his ability, he lost control at high speed. Climbed to 1,000 feet. Full power, straight ahead, first, then push over, flapping to a vertical dive. Then every time his left wing stalled on an upstroke, he'd roll violently left, stall his right wing, recovering, and flick like fire into a wild, tumbling spin to the right. He couldn't be careful enough on that upstroke. 10 times he tried. And all 10 times, as he passed through 70 miles per hour, he burst into a churning mass of feathers, out of control, crashing down into the water. The key, he thought at last, dripping wet, must be to hold the wing still at high speeds, to flap up to 50 and then hold the wing still. From 2,000 feet, he tried again, rolling into his dive, beak straight down, wings full out and stable from the moment he passed 50 miles per hour. It took tremendous strength, but it worked. In 10 seconds, he had blurred through 90 miles per hour. Jonathan had set a world speed record for seagulls. But victory was short-lived. The instant he began his pullout, the instant he changed the angle of his wings, he snapped into that same terrible, uncontrolled disaster. And at 90 miles per hour, it hit him like dynamite. Jonathan Seagull exploded in midair and smashed down into a brick-hard sea. When he came to, it was well after dark, and he floated in moonlight on the surface of the ocean. His wings were ragged bars of lead. But the weight of failure was even heavier on his back. He wished feebly that the weight could be just enough to drag him gently down to the bottom and end it all. As he sank low in the water, a strange hollow voice sounded within him. "There's no way around it. I am a seagull. I am limited by my nature. If I were meant to learn so much about flying, I'd have charts for brains. If I were meant to fly at speed, I'd have a falcon's short wings and live on mice instead of fish. My father was right. I must forget this foolishness. I must fly home to the flock and be content as I am, as a poor, limited seagull." The voice faded, and Jonathan agreed. The place for a seagull at night is on shore, and from this moment forth, he vowed he would be a normal gull. It would make everyone happier. He pushed wearily away from the dark water and flew toward the land, grateful for what he had learned about work-saving, low-altitude flying. "But no," he thought, "I am done with the way I was. I am done with everything I learned. I am a seagull, like every other seagull, and I will fly like one. So he climbed painfully to 100 feet and flapped his wings harder, pressing for shore. He felt better for his decision to be just another one of the flock. There would be no ties now to the force that had driven him to learn. There would be no more challenge and no more failure. And it was pretty just to stop thinking and fly through the dark toward the lights above the beach.
Dark. The hollow voice cracked in alarm. Seagulls never fly in the dark.
Jonathan was not alert to listen. It's pretty, he thought. The moon and the lights twinkling on the water, throwing out little beacon trails through the night, and also peaceful and still.
Get down. Seagulls never fly in the dark. If you were meant to fly in the dark, you'd have the eyes of an owl. You'd have charts for brains. You'd have a falcon's short wings.
There in the night, 100 feet in the air, Jonathan Livingston Seagull blinked. His pain, his resolutions, vanished.
Short wings. A falcon's short wings. That's the answer. What a fool I've been. All I need is a tiny little wing. All I need is to fold most of my wings and fly on just the tips alone. Short wings.
He climbed 2,000 feet above the Black Sea. And without a moment for thought of failure and death, he brought his forewings tightly into his body, left only the narrow swept daggers of his wingtips extended into the wind, and fell into a vertical dive.
The wind was a monster roar at his head, 70 miles per hour. 70 miles per hour, 90, 120, and faster still. The wing strain, now at 140 miles per hour, wasn't nearly as hard as it had been before at 70. And with the faintest twist of his wingtips, he eased out of the dive and shot above the waves, a gray cannonball under the moon. He closed his eyes to slits against the wind and rejoiced. 140 miles per hour? And under control? If I dive from 5,000 feet instead of 2,000, I wonder how fast...
His vows of a moment before were forgotten, swept away in that great swift wind. Yet he felt guiltless, breaking the promises he had made himself. Such promises are only for the gulls that accept the ordinary. One who has touched excellence in his learning has no need of that kind of promise. By sunup, Jonathan Gull was practicing again. From 5,000 feet, the fishing boats were specks in the flat blue water. Breakfast flock was a faint cloud of dust motes circling. He was alive. Trembling ever so slightly with delight, proud that his fear was under control, then, without ceremony, he hugged in his forewings, extended his short angled wingtips, and plunged directly toward the sea. By the time he passed 4,000 feet, he had reached terminal velocity. The wind was a solid beating wall of sound, against which he could move no faster. He was flying now straight down at 214 miles per hour. He swallowed, knowing that if his wings unfolded at that speed, he'd be blown into a million tiny shreds of seagull. But the speed was power, and the speed was joy, and the speed was pure beauty. He began his pullout at 1,000 feet, wingtips thudding and blurring in that gigantic wind, the boat and the crowd of gulls tilting and growing meteor fast directly in his path. He couldn't stop. He didn't know yet even how to turn at that speed. Collision would be instant death. And so, he shut his eyes. It happened that morning then, just after sunrise, that Jonathan Livingston Seagull fired directly through the center of Breakfast Flock, ticking off 212 miles per hour, eyes closed, in a great roaring shriek of wind and feathers. The Gull of Fortune smiled upon him this once, and no one was killed. By the time he had pulled his beak straight up into the sky, he was still scorching along at 160 miles per hour, When he had slowed to 20 and stretched his wings again at last, the boat was a crumb on the sea, 4,000 feet below. His thought was triumph. Terminal velocity. A seagull at 214 miles per hour. It was a breakthrough. The greatest single moment in history of the flock. And in that moment, a new age opened for Jonathan Gull. Flying out to his lonely practice area, folding his wings for a dive from 8,000 feet, he set himself at once to discover how to turn. A single wingtip feather, he found, moved a fraction of an inch, gives a smooth sweeping curve at tremendous speed. Before he learned this, however, he found that moving more than one feather at that speed will spin you like a rifle ball. And Jonathan had flown the first aerobatics of any seagull on Earth. He spared no time that day for talk with other gulls, but flew on past sunset. He discovered the loop, the slow roll, the point roll, the inverted spin, the gull bunt, the pinwheel. When Jonathan Seagull joined the flock on the beach, it was full night. He was dizzy and terribly tired. Yet in delight, he flew a loop to landing with a snap roll just before touchdown. When they hear of it, he thought, of the breakthrough, they'll be wild with joy. How much more there is now to living. Instead of our drab slogging forth and back to the fishing boats, there's reason to life. We can lift ourselves out of ignorance. We can find ourselves as creatures of excellence and intelligence and skill. We can be free. We can learn to fly. The years ahead hummed and glowed with promise. The gulls were flocked into the council gathering when he landed, and apparently had been so flocked for some time, they were in fact waiting. Jonathan Livingston Seagull, stand to center. The elder's words sounded in a voice of highest ceremony. Stand to center meant only great shame or great honor. Stand to center for honor was the way Gull's foremost leaders were marked. Of course, he thought, the breakfast flock this morning, they saw the breakthrough. But I want no honors. I have no wish to be leader. I want only to share what I found, to show those horizons out ahead for us all. He stepped forward. Jonathan Livingston Seagull, said the elder, stand to center for shame in the sight of your fellow gulls. It felt like being hit with a board. His knees went weak, his feathers sagged. There was a roaring in his ears. Centered for shame? Impossible. The breakthrough. They can't understand. They're wrong. For his reckless irresponsibility, the solemn voice intoned, violating the dignity and tradition of the gull family. To be centered for shame meant that he would be cast out of gull society, banished to a solitary life on the far cliffs. One day, Jonathan Livingston Seagull, you shall learn that irresponsibility does not pay. Life is the unknown and the unknowable, except that we are put into this world to eat, to stay alive as long as we possibly can. A seagull never speaks back to the council flock. But it was Jonathan's voice raised. Irresponsibility, my brothers? He cried. Who is more responsible than a gull who finds and follows a meaning, a higher purpose for life? For 1,000 years we have scrabbled after fish heads, but now we have a reason to live, to learn, to discover, to be free. Give me one chance. Let me show you what I found. The flock might as well have been stone. The brotherhood is broken, the gulls intoned together, and with one accord, they solemnly closed their ears and turned their backs upon him. Jonathan Seagull spent the rest of his days alone, but he flew way out beyond the far cliffs. His one sorrow was not solitude, it was that other gulls refused to believe the glory of flight that awaited them. They refused to open their eyes and see. He learned more each day. He learned that a streamlined, high-speed dive could bring him to find the rare and tasty fish that schooled 10 feet below the surface of the ocean. He no longer needed fishing boats and stale bread for survival. He learned to sleep in the air, setting a course at night across the offshore wind, covering 100 miles from sunset to sunrise. With the same inner control, he flew through heavy sea fogs and climbed above them into dazzling clear skies. In the very times when every other gull stood on the ground, knowing nothing but mist and rain, he learned to ride the high winds far inland to dine there on delicate insects. What he had once hoped for the flock, he now gained for himself alone. He learned to fly and was not sorry for the price he had paid. Jonathan Seagull discovered that boredom and fear and anger are the reasons that a gull's life is so short. And with these gone from his thought, he lived a long, fine life indeed. They came in the evening then, and found Jonathan gliding, peaceful and alone, through his beloved sky. The two gulls that appeared at his wings were pure as starlight, and the glow from them was gentle and friendly in the high night air. But most lovely of all was the skill with which they flew, their wingtips moving a precise and constant inch from his own. Without a word, Jonathan put them to his test, a test that no gull had ever passed. He twisted his wings, slowed to a single mile per hour above stall. The two radiant birds slowed with him, smoothly locked in position. They knew about slow flying. He folded his wings, rolled, and dropped in a dive to 190 miles per hour. They dropped with him, streaking down in flawless formation. At last, he turned that speed straight up into a long, vertical, slow roll. They rolled with him, smiling. He recovered to level flight and was quiet for a time before he spoke.
"Very well," he said. "Who are you?"
"We're from your flock, Jonathan. We are your brothers." The words were strong and calm. "We've come to take you higher, to take you home." "Home I have none, flock I have none. I am outcast, and we fly now at the peak of the great mountain wind. Beyond a few hundred feet, I can lift this old body no higher." "But you can, Jonathan, for you have learned one school is finished, and the time has come for another to begin." As it had shined across him all his life, so understanding lighted that moment for Jonathan Seagull. They were right. He could fly higher, and it was time to go home. He gave one last look across the sky, across that magnificent silver land where he had learned so much. "I'm ready," he said at last. And Jonathan Livingston Seagull rose with the two star-bright gulls to disappear into a perfect dark sky. Part 2. Thank you. "This is heaven," he thought, and he had to smile at himself. It was hardly respectful to analyze heaven in the very moment that one flies up to enter it. As he came from Earth now, above the clouds and in close formation with the two brilliant gulls, he saw that his own body was growing as bright as theirs. True, the same young Jonathan Seagull was there that had always lived behind his golden eyes, but the outer form had changed. It felt like a seagull body, but already it flew far better than his old one had ever flown. "Why, with half the effort," he thought, "I'll get twice the speed, twice the performance of my best days on Earth." His feathers glowed brilliant white now, and his wings were smooth and perfect as sheets of polished silver. He began delightedly to learn about them, to press power into these new wings. At 250 miles per hour, he felt that he was nearing his level flight maximum speed. At 273, he thought that he was flying as fast as he could fly, and he was ever so faintly disappointed. There was a limit to how much this new body could do, and though it was much faster than his old level flight record, it was still a limit that would take great effort to crack. In heaven, he thought, there should be no limits. The clouds broke apart. His escorts called,
"Happy landing, Jonathan,"
and vanished into thin air. He was flying over a sea toward a jagged shoreline. A very few seagulls were working with updrafts on the cliffs. Away off to the north, at the horizon itself, flew a few others. New sights, new thoughts, new questions. Why so few gulls? Heaven should be flocked with gulls. And why am I so tired all at once? Gulls in heaven are never supposed to be tired or to sleep. Where had he heard that? The memory of his life on Earth was falling away. Earth had been a place where he had learned much, of course, but the details were blurred. Something about fighting for food, about being outcast. The dozen gulls by the shoreline came to meet him, none saying a word. He felt only that he was welcome and that this was home. It had been a big day for him, a day whose sunrise he no longer remembered. He turned to land on the beach, beating his wings to stop an inch in the air, then dropping lightly to the sand. The other gulls landed too, but not one of them so much as flapped a feather. They swung into the wind, bright wings outstretched, then somehow they changed the curve of their feathers until they had stopped. In the same instant, their feet touched the ground. It was beautiful control. But now Jonathan was just too tired to try it. Standing there on the beach, still without a word spoken, he was asleep. In the days that followed, Jonathan saw that there was as much to learn about flight in this place as there had been in the life behind him, but with a difference. Here were gulls who thought as he thought. For each of them, the most important thing in living was to reach out and touch perfection and that which they most loved to do, and that was to fly. They were magnificent birds, all of them, and they spent hour after hour every day practicing flight, testing advanced aeronautics. For a long time, Jonathan forgot about the world that he had come from, that place where the flock lived with its eyes tightly shut to the joy of flight, using its wings as means to the end of finding and fighting for food. But now and then, just for a moment, he remembered. He remembered it one morning when he was out with his instructor while they rested on the beach after a session of folded wing snap rolls. "Where is everybody, Sullivan?" he asked silently, quite at home now with the easy telepathy that these gulls used instead of screes and gracks. "Why aren't there more of us here?
Why, where I came from, there were...
Thousands and thousands of gulls, I know. Sullivan shook his head.
The only answer I can see, Jonathan, is that you are pretty well a one-in-a-million bird.
Most of us came along ever so slowly. We went from one world into another that was almost exactly like it, forgetting right away where we had come from, not caring where we were headed, living for the moment. Do you have any idea how many lives we must have gone through before we even got the first idea that there is more to life than eating or fighting or power in the flock? 1,000 lives, John, 10,000. And then another 100 lives until we began to learn that there is such a thing as perfection. And another 100 again to get the idea that our purpose for living is to find that perfection and show it forth. The same rule holds for us now, of course. We choose our next world through what we learn in this one. Learn nothing, and the next world is the same as this one. All the same limitations and lead weights to overcome. He stretched his wings and turned to face the wind. But you, John, he said, learned so much at one time that you didn't have to go through 1,000 lives to reach this one. In a moment, they were airborne again, practicing. The formation point rolls were difficult, for through the inverted half, Jonathan had to think upside down, reversing the curve of his wing and revising it exactly in harmony with his instructors. "Let's try it again," Sullivan said over and over. "Let's try it again." Then finally, "Good." And they began practicing outside loops. One evening, the gulls that were not night flying stood together on the sand, thinking. Jonathan took all his courage in hand and walked to the elder gull, who, it was said, was soon to be moving beyond this world. "Chiang," he said a little nervously. The old seagull looked at him kindly. "Yes, my son." Instead of being enfeebled by age, the elder had been empowered by it. He could outfly any gull in the flock, and he had learned skills that the others were only gradually coming to know. "Chiang, this world isn't heaven at all, is it?" The elder smiled in the moonlight. "You are learning again, Jonathan Seagull," he said.
"Well, what happens from here? Where are we going? Is there no such place as heaven?"
"No, Jonathan, there is no such place. Heaven is not a place, and it is not a time. Heaven is being perfect." He was silent for a moment. "You are a very fast flyer, aren't you?"
I enjoy speed," Jonathan said, taken aback but proud that the elder had noticed.
"You will begin to touch heaven, Jonathan, in the moment that you touch perfect speed. And that isn't flying 1,000 miles an hour, or 1,000,000, or flying at the speed of light. Because any number is a limit, and perfection doesn't have limits. Perfect speed, my son, is being there."
Without warning, Chiang vanished and appeared at the water's edge, 50 feet away, all in the flicker of an instant. Then he vanished again and stood, in the same millisecond, at Jonathan's shoulder.
"It's kind of fun," he said.
Jonathan was dazzled. He forgot to ask about heaven.
"How do you do that? What does it feel like? How far can you go?"
"You can go to any place and to any time that you wish to go," the elder said. "I've gone everywhere and every when I can think of."
He looked across the sea.
"It's strange. The gulls who scorn perfection for the sake of travel go nowhere slowly. Those who put aside travel for the sake of perfection go anywhere, instantly.
Remember, Jonathan, heaven isn't a place or a time, because place and time are so very meaningless. Heaven is..."
Can you teach me to fly like that? Jonathan Seagull trembled to conquer another unknown.
Of course, if you wish to learn.
I wish. When can we start?
We could start now if you'd like.
I want to learn to fly like that, Jonathan said, and a strange light glowed in his eyes. Tell me what to do.
Chiang spoke slowly and watched the younger gull ever so carefully. To fly as fast as thought, to anywhere that is, he said, you must begin by knowing that you have already arrived. The trick, according to Chiang, was for Jonathan to stop seeing himself as trapped inside a limited body that had a 42-inch wingspan and performance that could be plotted on a chart. The trick was to know that his true nature lived, as perfect as an unwritten number, everywhere at once across space and time. Jonathan kept at it fiercely, day after day, from before sunrise till past midnight, and for all his effort, he moved not a feather width from his spot. Forget about faith, Chiang said it time and again. You didn't need faith to fly. You needed to understand flying. This is just the same. Now try again. Then one day, Jonathan, standing on the shore, closing his eyes, concentrating, all in a flash, knew what Chiang had been telling him. Why, that's true. I am a perfect unlimited gull. He felt a great shock of joy.
Good, said Chiang, and there was victory in his voice.
Jonathan opened his eyes. He stood alone with the elder on a totally different seashore. Trees down to the water's edge, twin yellow suns turning overhead.
At last you've got the idea, Chiang said. But your control needs a little work.
Jonathan was stunned. Where are we? Utterly unimpressed with the strange surroundings, the elder brushed the question aside. We're on some planet, obviously, with a green sky and a double star for a sun.
Jonathan made a scree of delight, the first sound he had made since he had left Earth.
It works!
Well, of course it works, John, said Chiang. It always works when you know what you're doing. Now, about your control. By the time they returned, it was dark. The other gulls looked at Jonathan with awe in their golden eyes, for they had seen him disappear from where he had been rooted for so long. He stood their congratulations for less than a minute. I'm the newcomer here. I'm just beginning. It is I who must learn from you.
I wonder about that, John, said Sullivan, standing near. You have less fear of learning than any gull I've seen in 10,000 years.
The flock fell silent, and Jonathan fidgeted in embarrassment.
We can start working with time if you wish, Chiang said, till you can fly the past and the future. And then you'll be ready to begin the most difficult, the most powerful, the most fun of all. You will be ready to begin to fly up, and know the meaning of kindness and of love.
A month went by, or something that felt about like a month, and Jonathan learned at a tremendous rate. He always had learned quickly from ordinary experience, and now, the special student of the elder himself, he took in new ideas like a streamlined, feathered computer. But then the day came that Chiang vanished. He had been talking quietly with them all, exhorting them never to stop their learning and their practicing and their striving to understand more of the perfect invisible principle of all life. Then, as he spoke, his feathers went brighter and brighter, and at last turned so brilliant that no gull could look upon him.
Jonathan, he said, and these were the last words that he spoke. Keep working on love.
When they could see again, Chiang was gone. As the days went past, Jonathan found himself thinking time and again of the earth from which he had come. If he had known there just a tenth
just 1/100th of what he knew here, how much more life would have meant. He stood on the sand and fell to wondering if there was a gull back there who might be struggling to break out of his limits, to see the meaning of flight beyond a way of travel to get a breadcrumb from a rowboat. Perhaps there might even have been one made outcast for speaking his truth in the face of the flock. And the more Jonathan practiced his kindness lessons, and the more he worked to know the nature of love, the more he wanted to go back to Earth. For in spite of his lonely past, Jonathan Seagull was born to be an instructor, and his own way of demonstrating love was to give something of the truth that he had seen to a gull who asked only a chance to see truth for himself. Sullivan, adept now at thought-speed flight and helping others to learn, was doubtful. "John, you were outcast once. Why do you think that any of the gulls in your old time would listen to you now? You know the proverb, and it's true. The gull sees farthest who flies highest. Those gulls where you came from are standing on the ground, squawking and fighting among themselves. They're 1,000 miles from heaven, and you say you want to show them heaven from where they stand? John, they can't see their own wingtips. Stay here. Help the new gulls here, the ones who are high enough to see what you have to tell them." He was quiet for a moment, and then he said, "What if Chiang had gone back to his old world? Where would you have been today?" The last point was the telling one, and Sullivan was right. The gull sees farthest who flies highest. Jonathan stayed and worked, with the new birds coming in. They were all very bright and quick with their lessons. But the old feeling came back, and he couldn't help but think that there might be one or two gulls back on Earth who would be able to learn too. How much more would he have known by now if Chiang had come to him on the day that he was outcast? "Sully, I must go back," he said at last. "Your students are doing well. They can help you bring the newcomers along." Sullivan sighed, but he did not argue. "I think I'll miss you, Jonathan," was all he said. "Sully, for shame," Jonathan said in reproach, "and don't be foolish. What are we trying to practice every day? If our friendship depends on things like space and time, then when we finally overcome space and time, we've destroyed our own brotherhood. But overcome space, and all we have left is here. Overcome time, and all we have left is now. And in the middle of here and now, don't you think that we might see each other once or twice?" Sullivan Seagull laughed, in spite of himself. "You crazy bird," he said kindly. "If anybody can show someone on the ground how to see 1,000 miles, it'll be Jonathan Livingston Seagull." He looked at the sand. "Goodbye, John, my friend."